Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Clive Anderson. Welcome to My Seven Wonders. In ancient times, the greatest works of mankind, such as the Great Pyramid of Giza or the fabulous Hanging Gardens of Babylon, were celebrated as wonders of the world. And like seas, days of the week and deadly sins, there were always seven of them. More recently, the Great Wall of China, the Taj Mahal, even the London sewage system have appeared on lists of modern or technological wonders. Other Magnificent Sevens salute extraordinary natural phenomena such as the Grand Canyon or the Great Barrier Reef. But what are the seven wonders you would put on your personal list? Well, that's the question I ask my guests in this podcast, and the guest I'm asking today is Sir Trevor MacDonald, who in his many years presenting the news on television was frequently voted Britain's favourite or most respected newscaster. Before he occupied the ITN newscaster's desk, Sir Trevor had worked as a journalist in a variety of roles on television and before that radio, reporting politics, sport and other aspects of the news in Britain and before that the Caribbean. And since giving up his desk job, he's presented a variety of documentaries which have taken him to all sorts of places all around the world. So, Sir Trevor, you've probably reported on and seen as many horrors, or rather more horrors than there are wonders. Did it ever get to you? Did you get depressed by the news stories that you were presenting?
I was always distressed when children were involved. And, and when you went to places where there was civil disturbances or, you know, violence of one sort or the other, mainly political. But the people who suffered and the people whose suffering affected me most was that of children.
Yeah.
You know, because they seem to have had no part in this, yet they were part of it because they were having to endure what others did. And that always distressed me. I mean, you try in a way to put some of this out of your mind, but the suffering of children stayed with me more.
But I mean, it's in the nature of news, though, that it's always the, well, not always, but almost entirely always the bad stuff. You know, if one pensioner walks home from a coffee morning and gets mugged for her pension, that's a news story. Yeah. If a million walk home and they've had a happy time, of course.
You're absolutely right. Yeah. Absolutely right. One of my colleagues actually tried publicising a book about that sort of phenomenon.
So,
you know, we invest too much in bad news.
That was Martin Lewis, another great newscaster.
That was Martin
But I think
Lewis.
He got a lot of flack for that.
Well,
he was sort of laughed at in a way.
Exactly. But, I mean, I now see, after many, many, many years,
I see
what he was saying.
Yeah.
You know, if five people die in some accident, it's perhaps not as good a story as if 50 have died. So we, you know, I think it's something that we must acknowledge.
And the other preliminary question I'd ask, since I'm interviewing you, I just wonder, because you've included in your career, which I didn't really focus on there, you've interviewed a lot of people.
Yes.
The great and the good and the bad and the ugly. And what people often ask me is, do you get nervous interviewing, you know, big stars or compared to other people? And, well, never mind what my answer is, but do you recall being nervous?
I'm always nervous.
Yeah.
Yes. And it doesn't matter whether the person is an ugly politician, ugly in the sense of his what he believes in, or somebody who is wonderful. I was terribly, terribly nervous about interviewing Nelson Mandela.
Yeah.
Because I got the chance to do the first ever television interview.
The very first when he came out of prison.
Exactly. Yes. And that itself was nerve-wracking.
Yeah. And were you nerve-wracked because you thought this is a historic moment and I don't know how you would muck it up. It'll be
it was an extraordinary thing because this man had been talked about so much but never seen.
Yeah.
And here was I going to see him and actually ask him questions. And you know, you had some very good questions to ask, you thought, you know, how on earth would he ever come to an accommodation with the National Party? How on earth was he going to do this? And to fulfill all the things which were heaped on him, you know, yeah. And I thought so. Yeah, I was very, very nervous. On the other hand, my nervousness about interviewing Saddam Hussein was entirely different.
Well, you thought he might have you thrown into jail for, yeah, for impertinence.
Exactly. And I was, you know, and, you know, Saddam Hussein, when he appeared, was fine as an interviewee. The people around him, the security guards and everything, that made me very nervous. You know, yeah. Getting in a car to be told, you know, be ready to leave at 10 o'clock with no idea of where you were going.
Yeah.
And to a presidential palace, it turned out, you know, to stay the night. We never told that.
Yeah.
And then taking a short notice to see the president. So, yeah, I was always nervous. And, of course, nervous about preparing to do the thing well.
Yes, have the information to hand. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. Well, you know all about
it. Well, to an extent, but your experience is a bit different. Can I just, one more question about Nelson Mandela. At the stage when you were interviewing him, did you know the sort of person he was going to turn out to be after those years in prison? He might have been very bitter and angry and vindictive, or he might have been, well, let's say the wise person that he evidently was, but you might not have known that at the beginning.
It is the perfect question in that I was absolutely astonished at how conspicuously unbitter he was. Mm. And I said, you know, there is no way you're going to do this deal with the current political leaders.
Yeah.
And you know, and you must have been treated so badly. 27 years.
Yes.
You know, an unconscionably long time.
Yeah.
In
dreadful conditions.
All in the past, he said. you know, and didn't want to talk about how badly he was treated and had this very optimistic view. He said, and I always remember this, he said, when I was trying to point out that a deal with the National Party is going to be very, very difficult, he said, if you're prepared to sit down and talk seriously,
yeah,
everything is possible. And I said, surely not everything. You know, some things, but, yeah, you know, the fundamental principles are going to be very difficult. If you're prepared to talk seriously, he said, everything is possible.
Right.
He was an optimist. He was unbitter.
Yeah.
He was, in his way, pretty charming. All of which, after 27 years in prison, I had not expected at all.
Yes. Well, you called your memoirs, your autobiography, An Improbable Life. So, for anybody really to be in that position, to be interviewing Nelson Mandela, you know, wherever you started, wherever he started, that was one of the great improbable events that you could take part in.
I never thought in any aspect, in any phase of my life, that I would end up doing something like that.
All right, well, we better get on to your wonders, though. And your first wonder is tropical sunsets. So now, are you thinking tropical suns in terms of romantic, or does this take you back to, you know, with a, I don't know, a girlfriend, a wife, or a potential girlfriend, or is back to your childhood?
Back to my childhood, not very early childhood, but, you know, in my teens and so on. There was a part of the area I lived in Trinidad where if you went out on this promontory, you could see this wonderful sight of this huge, huge ball of sun.
Yes.
Sinking beyond, you know, into the horizon, sort of, and going into the water.
Yeah.
You know, it was over water. And I find I couldn't possibly live in two places at the same time. And when I came to England, I didn't sit yearning for things in the Caribbean.
Yeah.
But occasionally, I thought of those days when I would sit there and watch the sun go down. And there was this theory, I'm not too sure whether it's true or not, that if you watch the minute it hits the water, there's a blue flash or something.
Oh.
I don't remember whether I ever saw that or whether...
You sat looking for it.
Whether it's even true, but you sat there.
Yeah.
And it's a slightly, you're absolutely right. It's a slightly romantic reminiscence about my life in the tropics. And particularly so, as I said, I don't sit looking back in the dead of winter at tropical days.
No.
Because unlike many people, I couldn't live in two places at the same time.
Yes.
And I came to England and I had to devote my time and my efforts and, you know, everything I had into doing a job in England. So I don't, you know, I don't look back too much, but those sort of evenings, you know, tropical evenings in the Caribbean, peaceful and calm. And there was nobody on this promontory where, you know, I could do it on my own. And it was really, really lovely.
Okay. Well, look, just to sort of establish, you know, the time frame of this, if I'm getting my facts right, you were born in 1939 in Trinidad. And thinking about it, of course, in your very early years, the war, the World War was going on.
Yeah.
Did that have an effect on Trinidad? Were there young men going off to fight for the British Empire?
I saw occasionally you would see people marching around and so on.
Yeah.
And in my childhood days, wondering what the hell they were doing and why were they doing this? And of course, it was much later that I became, you know, very aware of the involvement that West Indians and, in fact, people from all over the Commonwealth had in the World War.
And another thought occurs to me that in this country, in Britain, we're so aware of the deprivations of the war and the, you know, the interruption to shipping. But for islands in the Caribbean, that must have had a very serious effect as well. Maybe you've been too young to realize.
No, but a serious economic effect.
Yeah.
And you're absolutely right. I think my most persistent memory is of rationing.
Yeah.
And the fact, you know, as a colony, all our stuff came from across the seas. And the war stopped that with the help of the German boats
and
so on.
Well, I'm not trying to stir up old wartime, remember. So what age was it that you left, you know, effectively leaving Trinidad?
I left a very, very long time ago.
In your age, were you 15, 25, 35? What was your age that you left there?
I was in my late 20s, early 30s.
Yeah.
So I've now been living here much longer than I've lived in the West Indies.
But you'd already got a career in broadcasting there.
Yes, I started broadcasting there. It's all I wanted to do, which was very annoying to my parents, who the generation into which I was born, people had to be a doctor or a lawyer.
Yes.
A third thing was an engineer or something like that.
Accountant might just about do.
An accountant might just about do it. But saying that you wanted to be a journalist, I hope I'm not wrong in interpreting this, but I don't think my father had ever heard the word journalist, and he certainly didn't know what it meant.
Yeah.
And so for me to decide that is what I wanted to do, what was a bit of a shock.
Yes. And have I got this right? You have, you know, dual heritage, African and Indian. Did that make a difference in terms of the influences that came on
you? Not particularly. I think my people from in Trinidad came either from Africa or from India. And I met my grandmother and some of my father's relatives, and they were definitely, you know, from the Indian side of the family.
Yes.
And and my mother, you know, was sort of Afro-Caribbean. So, but I mean, that's pretty common where I came from.
Sure, yes, it's a great admixture in that part of the world.
I mean, a great admixture.
And even the European influences are a mixture depending on which island have been overtaken by the Netherlands, France,
Trinidad,
Spain.
Was a very good example. Britain. I mean, it was Spanish, French. Yeah. I think even Dutch for a while.
Yeah.
There's an Oskin Scotch Road in Tobago.
Yeah.
And then, of course, British in 1797.
Yes.
When the Brits came and threw the Spanish out.
All right. Well, again, perhaps I'm not going to rake over old Anglo-Spanish wars.
I'll blame it on you, Clive. I'm not involved in this.
Now, and when you say became a journalist, but it would seem you were, from the word go, using your voice rather than just writing. So what about your voice? I think everyone would single out your voice as the epitome of correctly spoken BBC English, if I may call it.
Well, I was very lucky about that. My mother insisted on the use of proper English. And I was never quite sure where she got this from. I suppose it was the deep colonial influence.
Mm.
But, I mean, if we ever, you know, drifted into deep West Indian slang, my mother, who was very West Indian, would say, "And what does that mean?"
Yes,
you know. And if you stumbled over words or got things in the incorrect order, she'd say, "You know, spit it out, man, spit it out, speak properly."
Yes.
So that I blame, I should credit, all that thing about speaking properly and so on to my parents. They absolutely insisted on it.
Well, it paid dividends in a sense.
I'm terribly grateful.
I mean, perhaps in the modern world, people tend to say, "Oh no, you should stick with
that's right
the things around you rather than some real or imagined proper way of doing things.
Too late for me.
Well, you don't want to change it, do you? Otherwise, yeah, maybe it wouldn't have put you in the... anyway, so that's tropical sunsets. So it's a happy childhood memory, happy childhood, but you're not, you know, anxious to return there.
No.
Life has moved on for you.
I kind of, as people say, I kind of put my bucket down now. And I'm not too sure. I forget who it is. One of the Thoreaus said, you know, you can't go home again. And it's only in my later life that I think I understood precisely what that meant, is that, you know, you have changed.
Yes.
The place has changed. Yeah. And there is a kind of inevitable, sad crash when you try to bring the two together again.
Because you might have decided to build a house back somewhere in Trinidad and go back and discover, as you say, you'd moved on and had that place.
Yeah, it's really difficult.
But it lives on anyway. The happiness lives on in the sunset.
Ah, the mythical green flash during a sunset. It was first made popular by Jules Verne in an 1882 novel, and it's still leaking into pop culture through an occasional pirate movie sequel. Except it's not actually a myth. I know, it's weird. Usually we're debunking things people think are true, not the other way around. But the green flash is a real optical phenomenon, and it doesn't just happen right after the sun sets. You can see it right before sunrise, too. You can see it from any altitude and from anywhere in the world, but you have to have the right conditions.
Your second wonder is the Grand Canyon in America.
I remember going, I was spending some time in Las Vegas doing some work and got the chance to they take you on a flying trip to the Grand Canyon. Mm. And I remember that what they don't tell you, of course, is that this trip is pretty difficult because you're flying over the desert, which is not terribly, terribly pleasant. And half the people on the plane that I went in were never able to make it to the Grand Canyon because they were so ill.
The
shaking up of the plane.
Yeah.
But once you got there, it was really stunning. I mean, it's vast and magnificent. And you know, I've never seen anything quite like it. And I was, you know, really... It bowls you over, really. And I always remember it as, you know, of all the things I've seen, I thought it was in its vastness and you know, you look silently on this great, great, you know, thing. It's quite magnificent. And I've always remembered it. And these things are, you know, odd bits which sometimes idiosyncratically stick in your mind for no particular reason at all. But I remember that one. It probably is associated with the fact about, you know, the plane ride from Las Vegas and the fact that it could be done and all that. But yeah, I do remember the Grand Canyon.
Right. So is that a happy time as well, being in Las Vegas?
Yes, it was.
The
it
Grand
was a
Canyon
happy time.
Everything.
Yes, yes. Las Vegas is not one of my favorite places.
Yeah.
So to get away from it for a bit was a rather splendid idea. And it is, you know, undoubtedly one of the great sights in the world.
Right. Well, I haven't seen it, I'm afraid, but I have seen. I compare it. I've seen the Great Rift Valley in East Africa a few times.
Yes,
and that's had the same effect on me.
Yes.
I remember not initially flying over it, but driving or being driven to a point, and suddenly it opens up.
That's right. And it's that sudden. You know, you just come to this thing, and it open, and it's the most, you know, magnificent sight.
Yeah.
I remember that very, very fondly.
So you've been to America quite a lot. So you've interviewed. Is it different interviewing, let's say, an American president from a British prime minister?
Well, one of the American presidents that I interviewed was President Bush the Younger.
Yes.
And the problem about that was quite easy to define. He didn't like interviews. He didn't like being asked questions.
Yeah.
And he didn't like being asked particularly about why he was invading Iraq, because he had no idea what they were going to do there.
Yeah.
And when one questioned him about, you know, was he going to try to change the country and make it a more democratic nation? I mean, he was absolutely, you know, puzzled about that, really. And paid me the sort of backhanded compliment when I pressed him on this by saying, you know, you are one of these clever journalists who are trying to trip me up. And I said, can I have that in writing, Mr. President? I could use that when I apply for my next job.
Yeah.
No, but the problem about it was he didn't like interviews. President Clinton, on the other hand, quite liked talking.
Yes.
And showing off. I think, you know, in a nice way, the nicest possible way, you know, his erudition about the many, many issues.
Mm.
We were counseled about how little time the president had. And we couldn't get rid of him after a while because he stayed much longer than he should have.
Yes.
The one thing I remember most about President Bush was he actually cut off the interview halfway and said he didn't want to do any more. And I had 30 minutes to fill, and he would only do about 10 or 12.
Yeah.
And then said, I'll take you on a tour of the West Wing and the Oval Office.
Yes.
And the West Wing was fine. But I then went into the Oval Office being shown around by a sitting president.
Yeah.
And I suddenly thought, you know, journalists can be very blasé about things. But I suddenly thought, this is absolutely marvelous.
Yeah.
I mean,
another part of an improbable life.
Very, very part of an improbable life.
And presumably, President Clinton didn't you take you around the Oval Office? Because the Oval Office name is always a connotation now.
Yes, yes. We don't want to go there.
Yeah.
But days after, I would say to my colleagues who were there, on the camera crew, I said, you know, did we really go around the Oval Office in the company of a sitting president being shown around?
Yeah.
And I wish I could have told my mother that I'd done that, but she'd passed on by
now. All right. Well, of course, it was charming of him to do that, but it was also a device to stop you asking difficult questions.
It was absolutely wonderful. The only faux pas I committed, and I remember that, you remember your faux pas.
Yeah.
Was he kept calling me Sir Trevor, Sir Trevor. And I said at one point, I said, Mr. President, you know, this is a republic. And you don't believe in these honors. So, you know, my name is Trevor, you know, so we could just go Trevor. And I said, in many cases, some of these honors are not worth very much, you know. and a lot of people consider them pretty useless.
Yeah.
Oh, he said, you mustn't say that. He said, my father has one, which I had totally forgotten.
All right. An honorary knighthood.
His father was given an honorary knighthood.
Yeah.
So I put my foot in it there, but I think I managed to get out.
I think there are worse faux pas than that. Just while you're on your name, I saw a note that you were originally called George MacDonald, and you changed it to Trevor.
Yes, I think there's a funny story about that, actually. My name was never George.
Oh, right.
But I think that when I was born, my father was celebrating a little too much. It was his firstborn.
Yes.
And he turned up at the registry office, which you had to do. And in those days, the registry office were run by sort of fierce battle-axes of women.
Yes.
If one is allowed to say that.
I shouldn't have thought so, but anyway, I know what you mean.
And they were really, really fierce. And my father entirely forgot the name that he had been, he'd agreed with my mother. And so the lady got terribly impatient.
Yeah.
And she said, well, if you don't know and if you can't remember, I'll just call him George. So my name was never George. But
well, it was officially George.
According to that lady in the registry office, it was.
This could cause endless problems at some point. If your life had taken a different turn,
I know,
whether you're named down as Trevor or George or who's this, you're a complete fraud.
You could get into deep trouble.
Were you ever tempted to revert to use George?
I was always quite happy with what I was
called. Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Now, just one more, if I can, just because you mentioned talking to President Bush, the younger, about the Iraq war. And I was just interested because we're talking about America. But was that very different from, let's say, talking to Tony Blair, the prime minister, obviously, in this country at the time, about the same issue?
Yes. Tony Blair was very interesting to talk to because he said, look, I did this. You may not agree.
Yeah.
At the time, I thought it was the best thing to do. And that is what it must stand. And in a way, that's rather difficult to puncture because there's an air about it of, you know, I would not say of being, you know, self-righteous or anything like that. But it meant that there was very little more you could say, you know, because he admitted, he said, look, you know, I did this. I thought it was the best idea at the time. You may not agree, but that is the way it stands.
That's looking back, though, at the time. If you say for George Bush, well, what are you doing this for? He didn't really have an answer in your account, and people would understand that. But with Tony Blair, he would have had an answer because he's, he's just that kind of person, isn't he? He's
got but of course, even at that time, all during the run-up to the Iraqi invasion, there were very grave doubts about why it was being done.
Mm.
You know, there was a matter of Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction,
yes.
Although nobody had found any, and the United Nations team had gone in there and said there were no, or at least we could find no weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
So there was that difficulty.
Yeah.
You know, you say you're going in there to stop him doing weapons of mass destruction. And then he, in Tony Blair's case, he would say, well, I think he went as far as saying that they're these dictators who we must try and remove from the world.
Yeah.
Well, jolly good idea. How do you do that? How do you go about doing it? So, you know, there was a bit of improbability about it.
Yes. And, it was an odd response to 9/11 that Iraq was the country was attacked.
Because Iraq had nothing to do with it.
Yes,
we discovered later.
Yeah, I think we were told of, you know, 45 minutes Iraq could attack.
Yes.
It's not Britain, it was maybe some base on Malta or something.
In Cyprus.
From the desert of the Grand Canyon, we're here for another attempt at what is, in light of recent events, no doubt one of the most highly anticipated motorcycle jumps in history. You'll recall it was just 3 weeks ago that bad weather temporarily washed out Robbie's dream of jumping a motorcycle across the Grand Canyon. And so we're back in this most majestic of natural wonders, this time, as you can see, under sunny skies, for another attempt at what seems unnatural.
But your next wonder is equally grand within itself, whatever its relation to you, which is Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. So why have you selected this?
I always liked Beethoven's work, and I thought the Ninth Symphony was sort of audacious, you know, having a choral end to it.
Yeah.
And I remember in my youth, and I haven't seen this written down for some time, that Dag Hammarskjöld, when he was Secretary General of the United Nations, you used to insist on playing, you know, certainly the choral bit of the symphony at the beginning or the end of a United Nations deliberation. And it's, you know, Schiller's Ode to Joy.
Yeah.
And I always thought that was a rather sort of appropriate thing, the United Nations, which could be very fractious at times. And this seemed to be a very unifying factor for the rest of the world and the delegates who were there. And I always thought that was, you know, that was a really nice touch, especially for an institution which is so deeply political. And it gave me even more regard for the symphony, which I love. I love all, you know, Beethoven's works. And, you know, I got luckily introduced to it at school and have been, devoted to this music ever since.
So you're a fan of music. Do you play music yourself? Are you a musical person?
I played the piano very badly.
Mm.
But I couldn't conceive of a life where you didn't spend long hours listening to music.
Yes.
And I go to concerts. And very, very luckily, in my years in Trinidad, I remember the Halle Orchestra came with Sir John Barbarolli and played, Vaughan Williams and Beethoven and things like that. And it was always wonderful.
Yes.
Music has always been a great, great part of my life.
You've obviously had plenty of opportunities in later years, later than those early Caribbean years, to listen to music. I suppose if you'd been more BBC rather than ITV, you'd have been a natural for presenting proms, they must have invited you to be in the audience at any rate.
I've been to the proms.
Yes.
Yeah.
Is that the sort of context of this?
Yes,
music
I've always thought it was quite wonderful. But I've loved going to concerts great. And my musical tastes vary a lot and.
Grand opera and rock opera, or
grand opera. Yes,
yeah.
I'm a trustee of Opera Holland Park, and
yes.
Not that I'm an expert on it, but I like the tuneful ones. You know, Puccini would
yes.
do
Italian
nice
opera. Role.
Yes.
What about Wagner or something like that? Do you like a 9-hour?
I mean, it's I've never done the 9-hour trial.
Yeah.
But yes, I mean, as you grow older, you appreciate even those that you tended to discredit, in earlier life.
Well, now, oddly enough, Beethoven's Ninth, you say it was good for the United Nations. I wasn't aware of the connection to the United Nations, but it has been used by lots of different political organisations across the... There's a thing called the Pervert's Guide to Ideology, which somebody made, a philosopher.
Never heard of that.
Well, no, but he... Well, it's a communist philosopher called Slavoj Žižek, and he lists, and it's just, but this, the ode to joy and the Beethoven's Ninth has been used by Nazism, Bolshevism, the Chinese Cultural Revolution, the East-West German Olympic team, Southern Rhodesia, as it then was, the leader of the Shining Path, and of course the Council of Europe and the European Union.
And
so,
the European
so
Union,
it's
yes.
it's obviously very uplifting music, it, but it, it seems been, to attract politicians of, well, a range of dodgy ideologies and better ideologies.
Yes, I didn't realise it was so widely used by all the, that disparate group that you
mentioned. Well, there's no reason why you shouldn't like it as a piece of music.
No. And particularly in the context of the United Nations, though, which, however you conceive of it now and whatever you think about it now, was you know, came into being as an idea of trying to unite the nations of the world. So I think it was probably, or it is probably, most appropriate there.
I suppose in your career as a journalist and specifically as a newscaster as well, you have to be rigidly neutral on party politics and big issues. So, I mean, this is a European anthem. So that was another interesting time for news sources. I suppose it's come after your time as a newscaster. Because any hint that you're pro or anti-Europe, or pro or anti the government, pro or anti socialism or conservatism is to be criticised in somebody in your position. Have you relaxed a bit now, or do you stick to those positions?
No, I never found it. I've never found it terribly difficult to, you know, to keep your personal views more or less to yourself.
Yeah.
When I was reading the news, you know, you were supposed to impartially inform people of what was going on. And I still believe that that is the way news should be done. My particular views on it are quite irrelevant.
Yeah.
If I wanted to promote them, then I could probably buy my own radio station or my own television station and do that. But I never found it terribly difficult to be.
Well,
absolutely.
Well, people do that now, but of course, and it's
times have changed.
Yeah, it applies particularly the BBC. Almost everybody looks at the BBC, and well, not almost everybody. A lot of people who are active in the various areas either say it's a bunch of government spokesmen, or it's a nest of left wing over woke activists.
Yeah.
I mean,
and
I suppose you operated more in ITV, which is. Has a certain amount of that, but doesn't get quite that sort of ownership feel.
But we still, you know, I remember, I mean, I started, when I came to England, I went to the BBC at Bush House, so I started there. You know, even listening to the BBC in the West Indies, we always felt that, you know, what they set out to do, and they stated that what they set out to do was to present the news in a way which was fair, balanced, accurate. And I still believe that those are the codes by which this business should be done.
And in the long run, that's the way to get respect, rather, if you choose to start pushing it in one direction. It's the unconscious bias that sometimes people
I suppose so. And there are many instances when you could see where that would arise. But to be very honest, the other thing I felt about the news is, you know, you're sitting down in a studio in London trying to talk to people sitting in their rooms in Norfolk or somewhere in the Midlands. And you're trying to explain the complexity of what's going on in Afghanistan or in Syria or something. And I thought that was the more important part about the news, in, you know, informing people of what's going on, and to do that in a way which was non-biased you know, but the main thing was to be informative and well balanced, I think.
Do you think you were present for the glory days of newscasting, when there were 1, 2, 3 stations, you know, an impressive figure telling you the news, giving you the news? Now we get news on our phones before anybody at ITN or BBC or CNN have got a chance to, you know, get their shoes on.
It is, time has caught up with me.
No, it's good for you. It's like when you talk to rock stars, old rock stars had glory years.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's much harder to make a big living out of being making pop records. I mean, just to take another example.
But, you know, the one thing you do learn is that, you know, life moves on.
Yeah.
Things change, and there's nothing you can do about it. I still look back on the way you know, the role I had in presenting the news, you know, with a great deal of respect about what we tried to do. Yeah. And, you know, yeah.
Yeah. But in those days, the nation more or less did gather around the TV set to get the news. They hadn't heard it all day.
That's right.
They might have watched on the BBC. They might have watched on ITN. They might have had something a bit earlier on Channel 4 in later years. But other than that, there wasn't, you know, 24-hour rolling news available.
Right. It's changed.
Yeah.
Oh, bliss. Bliss and heaven. Oh, it was gorgeousness and gorgeosity made flesh. It was like a bird of rarest spun heaven metal, or like silvery wine flowing in a spaceship, gravity all nonsense now. As I slush it, I knew such lovely pictures.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi everyone, Marcus from the Football Ramble here. We know that keeping up with all the football can be quite a tricky task, even for those at the top of the game.
Wayne Rooney says he's been sleeping in his office.
Yep. Diligent.
Get
dedicated.
Some signings.
Get signings.
Get some signings done. Yeah, because everything's done by fax, isn't it?
Yeah.
So he can't go home.
I like my dinner in the dog. That's actually how I eat my food these days.
Even those who run the clubs are having a mare.
I guess the system they have at Barcelona is that someone can come in and be president for a bit and the destruction they leave is someone else's problem.
Thankfully, there's an easier way for you to keep up with all the football this season. Listen to the Football Ramble every weekday for the biggest stories from the Premier League and around the world. From the sublime to the ridiculous, the bust-ups to the cock-ups, it's your definitive guide to the new season. Just search Football Ramble in your podcast app to listen now.
The Football Ramble is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
All right, let's move on to perhaps cheerier stuff. I don't know. This, I think, comes as, well, I don't know, it's a surprise exactly, but comedy. It might surprise some people listening. Comedy is your next a choice, and that's all I know. So I don't know whether you're going to say stand-up comedy, sitcom, Shakespearean comedies, having a laugh with mates in the pub.
The idea of comedy in life, life is pretty disorganized, tough, unpredictable, with many harrowing bits. And I think the art of trying to find something which lightens the air and which makes you laugh and takes you out of the world in which you live with all its horrors and its, you know, discourtesies and all the problems. And I've always loved just sitting and being taken all out of that. Mm. And having spent a long time doing the news, especially that, you know, it is, you know, and you, as you said, covering disasters, which we are prone to do, it's always nice to sit back and to laugh. And for people who could make you laugh and for things which make you laugh. You know, it's the finest part of the day when you can sit down and after the news, you know, find something to laugh about.
So, what sort of area of comedy you like? Would you be Billy Connolly or Robin Williams, Michael McIntyre, Frankie Boyle, Frankie Howard?
Well, I mean, I go back to, you know, Morecambe and Wise and Only Fools and Horses, I mean, which my kids tease me endlessly about because I find that wonderfully funny.
Yeah.
The ability to make people laugh and the ability to, you know, have a contrivance which you know, makes people laugh. And so the plots in some of these are just so ludicrously, wonderfully funny.
Yes.
That I live on them and dine out on them.
Well, that's another thing that's possibly had its glory days or a bit behind it. The British sitcom with, as you say, a plot, which, whether it's Hancock or Steptoe or Only Fools and Horses, where you start with some characters, you have a lot of laughs with them and they're put back into position again, ready for the next episode.
I know.
There's not so many of those.
The way John Sullivan did this with Only Fools and Horses.
Yeah,
and
he did it for how many series?
And all that, and for so long.
Yeah.
And they were, you know, at times rather complex plots, really. I mean, they could, you know, justify a play on the stage, but it was done for laughs and it was... You know, people were funny and they were silly and they, you know, had grandiose ideas about the simplest things and so on.
Yeah.
And I've loved it all.
And they've stood the test of time, some of those ones you've mentioned, because they are endlessly repeated.
Still on. Still on. Yeah. Thank heavens. Yeah. And I spend a lot of time watching them still.
Well, and you did have a comedy career, and I know you did that, and you know that I know, because when you purported to retire from being a newscaster... You did an episode of How I Got News For You, and you were you were snapped up and made a program called News Night, News
That's
Tonight.
Right. Yeah.
And you were presenting a comedy program. You had comedians on, and I was able to. Well, I think three or four of those episodes I joined. Now, that comedy career of yours, which got going, was stymied by the fact that ITN was so needed to get you back in the saddle because they were struggling without you. So you had to...
nice thing to say.
Well, it is essentially true, though, isn't it? You were able to relax your stays and go a bit crazy but because you weren't the newscaster anymore. But they needed you back. So that was the end of News Night. But did you enjoy...
I enjoyed it immensely.
Yeah.
I think I was not very good as a presenter because I laugh so much, and you know you have to be, it has to be a semi-serious job in presenting
But the great thing is if you'd said that anything was even halfway rude or naughty,
you'd get
there was
in
a
trouble.
Frisson of frisson of excitement.
Exactly.
Oh, it's Sir Trevor MacDonald saying that. Frankie Boyle was on it, so I was on it. But you know, we could chip in with our things.
Gosh, you're getting me interested again in getting back into comedy. Yeah.
Well, I think so. I think you should revive that. The only thing I didn't like about it, and it's a very technical thing, is I thought the name News Night was a clever pun on the words at Euro, but it meant that anybody ever talking about it immediately had to explain, it's got an extra K in it. So I would have, in the meeting to decide the name of the programme, I would have been dead against that.
Yeah.
What about comedies? That
bit was beyond my pay grade.
I don't know if that's true or not, but I think other than that, it was charming. You were able to joke about, by then, the recently late Bernard Manning, which got a lot of headlines, but it was a funny moment. You were rude about him. In a way, he might have been rude about you or anybody else.
He probably would, yes. And we all would have taken it, I hope, in good spirit.
Yes. Now, you were, I don't think you were much lampooned, but of course, Lenny Henry did build quite a good bit of his career.
Career, yes. I frequently tell him that.
You were responsible for his...
Yes, that's right. I tell him.
He'd be nothing, let's face it.
He must occasionally bow down, yes.
Trevor McDonut, I think.
Yes, that's right.
Which wasn't the worst thing that you could have be described as.
It's amazing how long these things stay. I was up in Birmingham a couple of years ago, and some man, didn't realise I was in the proximity of the studio where this was done, which I don't think that bit no longer exists. And he came to me and he said, you know, with very great earnestness, he said, you know, I was the one who helped take you in through the back door when you did Lenny Henry. And I thought, gosh, what quaint memories people
that
have.
That's Tiswas, isn't it?
And Tiswas.
Yeah, you sort
actually
of,
appeared on it.
Yeah, ambushed him.
Yes,
he was doing you.
Yes,
and you turned up
and told
trying
him
to look offended.
He should try to improve his act. But what a great man Lenny Henry has turned out to
Yes,
be.
Another, I say Lenny Henry, Sir Lenny Henry.
Sir Lenny
so
Henry.
He's matched you for that, having taken the advantage of... what about the sort of political comedies that might match up, or the news comedies like The Day Today or The Thick of It? Does that appeal to you as a satire on the world you know about?
I think they're quite funny. I think to be able to find and you know, to be able to take fun, make fun out of... You know, current political situation. I think it's a great art, and a lot of it is funny. Yeah. I I hope it's not intended with any malice.
Yeah.
That's the way I like to conceive of.
I think sometimes there is a bit of malice.
Well, in some cases, I'm sure it is.
Yeah.
But I think, but even when it is, it can be still very funny.
Sure.
I mean, there could be some very funny cartoons about people. Yeah. I see them in the papers, you know, about government ministers and so on. But
they always love that, don't they? And they're the first one to want to buy the original.
And frame it and pub it on their wall.
Yes. Yeah. I'm trying to revive your comedy career in a sense.
Oh, right, okay.
But
thank you for that.
You don't have to make another programme like that, but you could, if you chose to, I'm sure you've been asked, you could be on Strictly Come Dancing. You could be, you know, in Big Brother or in the, you know, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, or any, or a cookery program, or, you know, like John Sargent, John Sargent, a serious journalist.
He did terribly well.
He did well, but there are endless, and politicians do it as well. Have you been asked to do all those various things?
I occasionally, but I think I've always thought, you know, I should try and stick to things I think I might be able to do.
Mm.
And some of those things you mentioned, I couldn't possibly do. No, I'm pretty happy with the lineup of things I've done so far.
No,
the comedy bits, you've excited me about more comedy programs, but
I'm going to rush forward with a proposal somewhere to get you going.
Thank you.
But I'm also suggesting, I mean, I suppose Strictly Come Dancing is the biggest profile one. I bet they've asked you and have said, come along.
I haven't been asked for that, no, to my knowledge.
No, okay, that's a very political answer. But I will. I'm glad we've mentioned it because I'm sure that's going to provoke a request. But don't blame me if you do it and it all goes horribly wrong. And cooking, you wouldn't do it's another great, like Ed Balls has made a bonus career.
I'm not very good at it, and I eat a lot of rubbish food. And
are you a very domesticated person?
I'm not a very domesticated person, so cookery programs are not my thing.
No.
There are many, many more people who do it so much better.
But that's sometimes the point, that they.
I know.
You want you to goof around a bit, maybe in a celebrity or a charity.
Yes,
version.
I appeared in a couple of programs when I was promoting my book, but otherwise I haven't.
Henri Bergson was a French philosopher who prefaced his essay on laughter by saying he wouldn't define the comic because it's a living thing. He argued laughter has a social function to destroy mechanical inelasticity in people's attitudes and behavior. Someone doing the same thing over and over, or building up a false image of himself and the world, or not adapting to reality by just noticing the banana peel on the ground. This is automatism, ignorance of one's own mindless rigidity, and it's dangerous, but also laughable. And comic ridicule helps correct it. The comic is a kinetic vital force, or élan vital, that helps us adapt.
Comedy, I might be a bit of a surprise to some people, not to me, because I'm, you know, fully aware of how you did pursue a comedy element. But let's the fifth of your great wonders is The First Days of Spring. Now, again, I don't know why you've included this.
Why? When I came to England, I couldn't conceive of any other form of life other than eternal sunshine, as it is in the West Indies, with the occasional rainy patch, which is pretty dreadful and can be, and of course the occasional hurricanes and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, so it's remarkable. Often, and there are, like, you know, test matches or something.
Yeah,
and we think of the Caribbean as eternal sunshine.
That's
but there's huge rainstorms.
I know, I know, and even more so now. I didn't ever get along with snow and winter and never liked it. But after a while, having been born into and having, you know, loved eternally the idea of, you know, constant sunshine, I began to like the change of seasons.
Yes.
I think it's really, it makes the year much more livable if things change in order. And after you know, winter, with which I've never really got along terribly well, and I don't suppose I ever will now, it is really, really lovely and invigorating and wonderfully changing to have, you know, the coming of spring.
Yes.
I think, I mean, there's a Beethoven symphony, there's the sixth symphony, or is it the sixth, where he also, does that in musical terms. And it's always wonderful after the winter to have this, you know, have this change. And for somebody who never thought of a change of seasons as anything but a sort of vague concept,
yeah,
I find I really, really look forward to it. So it's absolutely wonderful.
Did you say earlier you first worked or came to Britain in when you were about 30? Is that
yes,
sort of age, late
yes,
20, 30? So had you got a fixed idea of what you might have gathered that the weather was going to be a bit changeable, but you might have had an optimistic view of what Britain was like. What I'm reaching towards, did Britain disappoint on first
yes,
acquaintance,
no,
or did it excite you from the word
go? It always excited me, but that is also something which is very much part of being born in a colony, a British colony.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, we learned very little about West Indian history.
Yeah.
And learned more about Trafalgar Square and about London being the metropolitan centre and about, you know, Wellington and Francis Drake on Plymouth Sound before he went out to hound the Spanish Armada and all that.
Yeah.
All that was part of our life. So one had this sort of picture of England and what England represented. It was the metropolitan centre, centre of empire. And so all that was very much part of your upbringing. And the reality was different. It was made slightly better for me by the fact that I came and I started working at Bush House in the Allwich then, which was a United Nations of broadcasters and broadcasting to the world.
Mm.
And so you fell into that with great glee. And it gave you a slightly biased idea of what Britain was really like working in Bush House. But it was a gloriously biased idea of what Britain what was.
Well, that's in more or less central London.
Yeah.
And central London does have its high points and excitements.
Right.
Even within London, there are vast areas which don't conform to an imperialist's description of London and the rest of the country. So I'm just wondering, when you first actually saw Britain, maybe when the weather was bad and you were maybe staying somewhere not quite as glorious as the Aldwych, it might have been, oh no, this isn't quite what we've been taught.
What have I done?
Yes.
And why on earth am I here?
Yeah.
Oh yes, there were those days and there were those thoughts.
Yeah.
But I was terribly fortunate in the fact that I very quickly, I mean, I got a job at Bush House before I came to London.
And there was that broadcasting back to the Caribbean.
And later to the World Service, to all around the world.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I didn't come here looking for a job. I was invited when I was in Trinidad to come to Bush House.
Yeah.
So that's a great, great, great difference. This was a golden, you know, entry into the place.
Yeah.
Of course, you realize then it was not all that. And then, you know, very fortunately and with great good fortune, I landed in ITN and stayed there for a very long time.
Yeah.
And was given, you know, every chance to do as much as I wanted to there. So,
and were you welcomed with open arms to be a reporter, somebody from the Caribbean as opposed to somebody from
Britain? Well, ITN did. I mean, of course, I learned much, much later that one of my editors said to me, many years after I'd been in the firm, that you know, people called up and said, who is that black West Indian guy?
Yeah.
And why is he reading the news? I was told the response was, you better get accustomed to him because he might be around for some time.
Yes.
But yes, I mean, I you know, there were some people who were probably not too happy with it, but it didn't affect me. It didn't affect my life.
Yeah.
I had a job to do, which was terribly competitive in an environment which I hadn't, you know, seen anything like that before.
Yeah.
And I had a mortgage to pay, so I put your head down and did the best you could.
March 20th marks the vernal equinox. In other words, the beginning of spring. During an equinox, the sun is shining directly over Earth's equator, which means day and night will be nearly identical in time length in this region. Makes sense, because the word equinox comes from the Latin words equus and nox, which means equal night. While the northern hemisphere prepares for warmer days during the vernal equinox, the southern hemisphere does the opposite during the autumnal equinox, the beginning of fall. Seasons change because of Earth's tilt on its axis.
We're talking about the first days of spring. I think we've gathered why that is coming to a temperate climate. It isn't all good, but at least the first days of spring make it seem it's getting better. But we're perhaps straying now into your next wonder. So that is campaigns promoting equality.
I've always admired people who start those campaigns. Inequality, in its most general sense, across the world, has always been a big, big, you know, a universal problem. And I've always admired, you know, people who you know, first have the idea about, you know, about making the world a more equal place and getting minorities a better chance. Minorities in the sense of all over the world. I'm not talking just about in Britain. You know, in every part of the world you look, there are people who chafe under the difficulties of inequality. You see it. And I've always, you know, I've worked a lot in America. So one saw it a lot there with, you know, Martin Luther King and people like that. And you know, you look at some of these things and you think it's improbable that they will ever survive and thrive. But in the end they do, and they make they make the news. Of course, we learned today, you know, in today's world, that there are always people who try to, you know, overturn any gains that have been made in people's fight for equality. But you know, it will remain one of the great things about our existence. You know, we must strive to be much better and to treat people much, much better. And I've always admired those who have sturdily campaigned in that effort.
No, I follow that. But from what you're saying before, and I may be getting a completely false impression, it's almost, not that you had a charmed existence, but you things went well for you from the word go and continue. You found a couple of good niches to operate in, and well, I mean, it's a big niche in ITN, but in the World Service before that. So it sounds like you personally have not had to confront a lot of difficulty.
But I've seen, I've been to places where it's the dominant issue.
Yeah.
And my admiration for the people who strive to do that. Yeah. I look, even today, you see people talking about, the Uyghurs in China or the Rohingya people in what used to be Burma and so on. And you know, still in parts of Southern Africa and all over the world, in Asia, and the caste system in India, which kind of enshrines a kind of inequality, I think, so sternly. And you see people fighting to change that, and they've always had my admiration. Mm. Although, as you say, I have been terribly, terribly lucky. I don't think I had an ability to transcend these things in any particular way. I was given great chances, and you know, I managed with great fortune to take them.
Yes,
you're right. I didn't have much to complain about in a personal sense.
No, I suppose the sort of question, if I just relating to it, you know, Margaret Thatcher was the first woman prime minister and achieved a great number of things as a woman. But what was often said to her or said about her, well, was she able to have promoted more women within her cabinet and within her government? And without going into that too much, that's just now, in your case, have you been in a position to affect this personally?
In a sort of minor way, I felt that one part of it was, because of who I am, was to make sure you did the stuff well and that you were seen, you mentioned earlier, to be, you know, straight up and unbiased and to do the job professionally.
Yeah.
And I think that probably paid some dividends. And I say that because people have said so to me.
Yeah.
Many, many people, West Indian parents have said to me, you know, we never thought that our son or daughter could do some broadcasting or be in the media. But having seen you, I think...
As a pioneer, you did it well.
Well, I hope in some small way. And I felt the one bit of responsibility I felt was, don't mess it up. Try and do it to the best of your ability.
Extra pressure in that sense.
The one thing which my West Indian heritage infused in me was the ability to work assiduously hard. You know, my life in television was a lot of hard work.
Yeah.
And it still is. You know, we talked about interviews and interviewing and so on. all that's, you know,
yeah,
you prepare well for that.
Put the hours in first.
Do it well.
Well, as far as particular campaigns promoting equality are concerned, in a sort of naive way, every now and then I think, well, things are much better now than they were in the, let's say, the 1950s or even 60s. And then things come along and you have a Black Lives Matter campaign and we're looking at, you know, deaths in custody. We're looking at, you know, things aren't...
Stop.
They're certainly not perfect. Yeah. And you get worried that, like the Windrush scandal. How was it?
Goes on.
Yes, which is extraordinary. That
it is absolutely extraordinary.
For some bit of paperwork that wasn't done in 1955.
I know. Do you know my prominent feeling, or one of my main feelings about that, is if people understood the sort of affection which was generated in the colonies about England and about the British Empire, West Indian men, their passages were paid here to come and fight for the mother country. There were some West Indian women who paid their own way to come here to support Britain in its campaign in the Second World War. And that's astonishing. This business about, or this feeling of affection for the mother country, was so profound. It is terrible to think that people are being deported and so on. You know, it's just, it isn't worth thinking about, really.
There's those oddities where even somebody who, you know, goes away and fights on behalf of ISIS and then they want to come home again, a young woman.
Yeah.
If they were a white British citizen doing that or doing anything like that, they'd have to come home because there's they've no other place for them.
No other place
for them. There's an argument that's been constructed. So, somebody with a Bangladeshi parents. Well, they can go to Bangladesh when there's no actual... It's just sort of, it's not how these things flare up.
Yes, but this is what I mean about this fight for equality.
Yeah.
The campaign for people being treated fairly.
Of course, there's been a recent commission on race and ethnic disparities. Tony Sewell chaired it.
That's right.
I mean, it's been much discussed and
raised some controversy.
And suggested, well, you know, race isn't the big thing that it was, and it's more to do with, you know, economic resources and maybe even class distinctions. But where do you stand on that?
I suppose all those things are part of it. Mm. But to think that the race issue has gone totally is, I think, a big mistake.
Yes. And I don't know how importantly we should regard this, because I know we're going to come on to sport in a moment, but, you know, big sports fan. But, you know, England did very well in the Euros for a while and failed at the last. And because three players happened to be black,
yes,
they took part in the penalty shootout. And there were so many things to think about in that game as to how it started well, tactics, penalty shootouts, which have traditionally gone wrong. But for some people, the one thing they noticed, and it was... But I would say, when I say how important is that just 100 nutters, or is it loads of people who are thinking?
I don't know what the figure would be, but I suppose there'll always be people like that, and people, you know, there'll always be questions like that raised, and people will always, you know, suffer the consequences, as those three players you mentioned did.
Yeah.
I think it's terribly sad, but it shows that there's much more work to do, and that this you know, this whole issue is not properly laid to bed yet.
Welcome back. And speaking of history, what a callback today to a scene from 57 years ago today. Americans descending on the nation's capital, peaceful crowds surrounding the reflecting pool with urgent pleas for voting rights, an end to police brutality, a call for racial justice and equality. Back on August 28 of 1963, it was called the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Remembered forever for the I Have a Dream speech by the late Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It had to be modernized for 2020, so today's gathering was billed as the Commitment March, Get Your Knee Off Our Necks. An obvious reference to the late George Floyd. It comes days after Jacob Blake was shot 7 times by police. And just like 57 years ago, today's speakers called for justice, equality, and an end to systemic racism.
Oh, well, that does bring us, I suppose not entirely happily, but does bring us to sport, because your seventh and last wonder of the world is the Olympic spirit. Yeah. So I suppose we're recording this in the middle of the Olympic Games, so I suppose that's nudged your
mind.
I've
spent many, many hours
Well, I was expecting something to do with sport because I know you used to be a sports reporter, and I've talked to you about sport before. But I was wondering whether your first instinct might have been to go with something like cricket, which isn't part of the Olympics.
Which is part of my yes.
Well, you've written
a
bio.
Cricket is a West Indian plague.
well, it certainly. Is, do I even suggest, was a very dominant player in the world of cricket. But then you've written the biographies of Clive Lloyd and Vivian Richards, who were, in their own slightly different ways, very dominant players of the game. And so I was kind of expecting, here's the list from Sir Trevor. I was expecting cricket to, but why the Olympics?
The Olympics, because I think I like not only the variety of sport one sees, but I like the fact that it's so vastly international.
Yes.
And you see a spirit there among the athletes who are from different parts of the world, some from parts of the world which are, you know, in contention with each other about various issues. And yet they come together and they get along marvelously well. And you would see occasionally somebody from Iran or somebody, you know, and their country is at odds with some other part of the world. Yet these two athletes representing such, you know, different parts of the world, they come together, they compete together, and they manage to congratulate each other sometimes through you know, not wholeheartedly, but they do. And I think that spirit, which I think is engendered by sporting activities and so on, is still wonderful. I still, you talk about cricket as being a kind of part of West Indian life, and it is. I say it is sort of West Indian disease. But one of the things about it was we always learned that you know, be magnanimous when you win, and be, you know, fairly gentle in your victory, and never be over, you know, preening about it. And I always thought that's a very good example of what life should be. And one sees it in the vast Olympic spirit. And I have great admiration for the fact that, I mean, so many, many nations, you never hear about some of them in general news items. And yet you see their athletes participating. And the pride and the joy, I think, which is, you know, engendered by people winning. And even when they've lost, just to have taken part in this grand international sporting event, I think is entirely wonderful.
And do you get interested in all these minority sports that we don't care about?
Some of which I can't even understand, even after it's been explained several times on the television.
Yeah.
We, Great Britain lost in a taekwondo match, and I couldn't understand what our guy had done wrong or badly.
The other issue is the finance. If we go back to, I don't know, the Los Angeles Olympics, Britain did really, really badly. And now we do pretty well. We sort of punch, if not above our weight, certainly our weight. And that comes down to really the money that's been raised from the lottery and other funding. And that's given us a, you know, we now appear on the medals table. The only one that's mysterious, to me anyway, is that how Australia does so well with a population fraction of ours.
Well, they're mad about sport.
They are, but But, you know, if you compare British medals to Germany, France, doing very well up there, obviously not going to beat, you know, somewhere like America, that's in China because of the population and also the wealth. But Australia, I think they're the ones that come away crowing about it. And you say another small country might get one gold medal or two gold medals, and they can say, right. Or Italy with, you know, bringing the 100 metres.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a proper victory, isn't it?
That was astonishing.
I wonder if we're going to see many more Italian winners of that. Because it's almost always, it was always America, and then it was Jamaica because of Bolt.
I'm glad you mentioned Jamaica because my West Indian friends were still saying they're still all in the shadow of Usain Bolt.
is there a rivalry in Caribbean islands, West Indian islands?
There is, but it's fairly mild.
Yeah.
I mean, they have more rivalries in politics and economic unions and so on and things like that. But I was glad to see, you know, there was one guy who did pretty well, I think, in one of the races.
Yeah.
And he was from Grenada, where my father was born. Yeah. So, you know, tiny, tiny island. We forget how small these islands are. I think the population of Grenada is not quite 250,000.
I mean,
it's less
they
than
do
that.
Very well.
So
yeah.
They do very well.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time, but I wonder if I should ask you this, that, you know, I've interviewed you before and I've seen you talking about yourself a bit, but you are a famous person, inherent in reading the news to millions of people and the other work you've done since. You've done a lot of program. Are you happy with talking about yourself, your personal life? I mean, I don't think people know much about your personal life.
No.
You come from the Caribbean Islands, and I know a bit more, which I haven't really gone into, but do you like that thing of being a famous person?
Not particularly. It doesn't do very much. I'm still astonished about what this word does for you. I was in, you know, Southwest London the other day, and well, it's not the other day. It's a couple of years ago now, and this guy, the bus driver, stopped at a non-bus stop.
Yeah,
and he came out and he said, "Could you may I take a picture with you? And could you sign this for me?" And I said, "But you have people on the bus. Yeah. I mean, you can't." He said, "Well, they can't go anywhere," which I suppose was absolutely true.
Yeah.
And then, of course, what happens inevitably is that they can't work the camera. Yeah. And I know that I'm not making this story up because somebody in an accountant's office across the street saw what was happening. Yeah. And this guy happily came out and helped to take the picture. And I still find that quite extraordinary, really. Yeah. And my son, when he was very much younger, my younger son, somebody came off a bicycle and rode onto the pavement and sort of slapped me on the shoulder. Mm. And my son said to me, he was only about 5 or 6 then, he said, "Dad, how does that guy know us?" I thought the "us" was very interesting. And you know, part of it is inexplicable, really.
And did you say to your son, "He doesn't know us, he knows me, because I'm a very important person who reads the news.
But so I still find a lot of it rather strange. Mm. But it's now what is part of your life now.
And sure, but did you go into being on screen? I suppose even being on a voice when you first...
You can never predict it. I had some hint of it I did some television in the West Indies. And of course, in those days, Trinidad had a population of just over 1 million. Mm. So you became instantly well known.
Yeah.
And people knew what car you drove and they knew where you lived and they thought they knew everything about you. And I found that's slightly odd and a little intrusive. But, you know, it's the life I chose to live. So you take there are great good parts of it. So
yes.
You know, like being shown around the Oval Office.
Yeah.
I take everything as it comes.
And you're still making programs that take you around the world a bit.
Yeah, I still.
I know when that's possible. I suppose
still
it's.
Us.
All right. Look, Sir Trevor McDonald, thank you very much for offering us your 7 wonders of the world. I have to select a sort of wonder of wonders from your list so that we can, you know, epitomize your list. And it's quite difficult. I am sorely tempted to make comedy because it's part of my campaign to get you back on air. But I have interviewed a lot of comedians in connection with this podcast, so I don't want to get obsessed with that area, even though it would be more interesting than you're
interested. Obsessed with comedy is not a bad idea.
No, it's not a bad idea. And it's more interesting that you're obsessed with it than a comedian is. But I think I'm going to put my serious hat on here and say that campaigns promoting equality is a more important wonder of the world, even than comedy or tropical sunsets.
But I would heartily agree with you, and it's terribly gracious of you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining me, Sir Trevor McDonald.
My 7 Wonders with Clive Anderson is a Stack production in association with Alaska TV and powered by the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.